like a 6. People treated it as though it were a 1. There's this strong tendency that every once in a while the community, you know, like certain parts of the community just awfully enjoys ganging up on brands. And, you know, we them ourselves criticize brands and we laugh at them and we tease them and whatever. So it's not as though it's all praise on a Blog to Watch ever. But still, I feel like this outlash was a little bit overdone. It was sort of an overreaction in a way. It's also hilarious how people are now crying back the old Bremen that they criticized just as viciously. You know, so I feel like, oh, I hate this design. Well, I miss the old design. I mean, just come on. You know, just it's at some point you make yourself look ridiculous. If it's like always bad, whatever happens, suddenly whatever used to happen or they used to make is just suddenly like acceptable.
Greetings and welcome to this week's Our Blog to Watch Weekly. It is a scant crew. We've only really got those that made it. It's like one of those war movies where they start off the Seven Samurai at the beginning or whatever, and then eventually it just whittles its way down. You know, the big guy gets taken out early, that's why Ariel's not here. The wee squirrely one that kind of gets stuck in, you know, he just comes a cropper crossing a lake, the alligators get him. Ripley, that's just what's happened to him. I think he's flight and all the rest of it. So we've had to try and find the hardy ones. And so we obviously just went to Yorkshire. But a Yorkshireman in Germany is what we really went for. So we've managed to dig up Rob Nudds from somewhere. He does look slightly dug up, it has to be said, after a week in Geneva. And David has survived, has managed not to kill anybody all week because he has got his prerequisite 8 hours sleep every night, no alcohol, no partying, no nothing. So David is also here. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you both?
Good morning. I've been better, but, you know, just it's all right. We are not the Navy SEALs. We do leave a man behind, and there are a few guys still in Geneva and scattered around different airports. So I made it.
That's probably the way to look at it, is we did leave men behind, namely Ariel and Ed in this particular case. Rob, did you leave any of your motley crew behind? Alan, is he sitting propping up a door of Burger King in Geneva somewhere?
I'd love to imagine it, but no, he got out of Dodge early. He left on Wednesday evening and left me to fend for myself for the last 3 days. Well, he had a good reason to leave, so no hard feelings there. But yeah, I am running on fumes, as I'm sure it looks.
Good stuff. Well, I guess we should get stuck into a quick recce of what happened in Geneva, what your highlights and lowlights were. So, David, first of all, because comparison is a thief of joy, was it better or worse than the year before? Compare and contrast.
In some ways it was better, in some ways it was worse. It was positively
hectic. Channeling Ariel with... Already channeling Ariel with the lack of definitive opinion.
Oh, it's such a non-answer, I know, but it's still true. I mean, it's I could have done with a few more releases, new watches, but it's just that the release cycle of brands has changed, shifted dramatically over the last 5 years. And whereas we used to get like this dump of watches for the rest of the year all at once, now even like the biggest brands, they do they schedule a few product launches into the year, and sometimes they hold on to those and they only show them in July or September or end of the year or something like that. So there are fewer releases, but still plenty to go through, that's for sure.
Yeah. Rob, I emailed or messaged Ariel and asked him a question about the show. Ariel, was it a good show or was it just necessary? Which way did you lean? Did you enjoy yourself? Was it just necessary that you had to go?
Yeah, I think from a Plexpo perspective, it was a necessary show. I think it was actually a good show overall. I thought that there was a lot more going on in town, and the Beau Rivage was absolutely stacked with 48 brands. And I know it's not officially Watches and Wonders, but that was an incredible addition to see that grow from last year. Plexpo-wise, though, it was, I'll say it was worse than last year. It was quieter. There weren't as many haymaker releases, as it were. It was more of an evolution than a revolution, as Alan likes to say. So,
so the pirates, as a certain leader of a certain crown-based brand, as he described everyone that was riding on the coattails of Pal Expo, the pirates were the highlight, were they?
Yeah, the hijackers, I mean, Beau Rivage, great. Time to Watch is, you know, it's worth going, I think, if you're interested in seeing the up-and-coming brands. But there wasn't anything show-stopping there either, really. But having everybody around, having all the people meeting in my office, the Grand Duke pub, as I like to say, was an absolute joy. So we got a lot of good work done there.
Good. So actual highlight of the week. So let's... Where did you go first? Where was the... You go into PAL Expo, you turned left or right. I assume left was Yodi, Rolex and Patek, as it has been, and going right... I think going right's Bob and Mercy first. I'm assuming most of you turned left rather than turned right, first of all. Where did you make a beeline for, Rob?
First meeting of the day for me was Grand Seiko. So that was quite cool, because I hadn't really had much chance to see Grand Seiko at a fair before. I've visited them privately, but it was good to see the releases, and I was quite impressed with some of the new dial work that they did, especially on the Spring Drive chronograph. But I want to see that kind of dial on a regular time, date, power reserve, Spring Drive. Chronograph layout never worked for me, so good stuff, but not quite in the format that I wanted.
And they had the, was it a Kodoki 2?
Oh, yeah.
Kodo.
The Kodo 2, the sequel. Was the sequel better than the original?
I guess it was a marginal improvement in some ways, but for me, that's always been a little bit of a stretch for Grand Seiko. I could maybe see it more as a Credo model. It doesn't really resonate with me that much. Impressive, absolutely, but not something I lost over.
David, where did you go? Turn left, turn right?
We turned left. Jake and I, we both went to... So the fair officially opens or starts at 8:30 a.m. But this time they allowed people in before that. And so we headed to the Rolex booth just for all our audience to see the curtain drop. Mm-hmm. Because it actually went downwards for whatever reason, so they didn't raise up. So I don't even know what happened there. And so this little mesh pit of people just came to be in front of the Rolex booth. And ironically, where the most, you know, where the crowd was the biggest, it was in front of a window that didn't have any novelties. So people had their phones out and like zooming and like recording and all the rest. And it's like technically, and the moment the curtains dropped and you could see what was behind them, everyone just rushed towards the other one. Like just these, you know, when you see on National Geographic that it's like this kettle of fish just like move like really fast. That is exactly how it happened, as people pivoted to the other window, which had the two new GMT Masters, which are like black and gray. The saddest looking, most basic something that is probably way easier to produce than the Pepsi bezel, so maybe that's why it came to be. And I'm sure they will sell boatloads of those, but still, it was like a very underwhelming start, not to mention it was 3 or 4 minutes late, which is not very on brand. And we were joking that if you know, they do this once a year and they are 3 minutes late. And if you divide that by 360 days, you are still within minus two plus 2 seconds, but it's still pretty bad, you know? So, you know, at 08:30, I think, you know, like they should try and be on time. Like there should be like a big red button that they press and like, boom, there the novelties are. And so, yeah, that's where we went first.
What they need is a Spring Drive from Grand Seiko so they can get the timing correct.
I'm sure they would appreciate that suggestion, Rick.
I love the whole iterative thing that Rolex do. I love that the Rolex iteration this year is that the curtain dropped rather than rose. That was Rolex's. That's just a reflection of all things Rolex. We're just going to make it a tiny little bit different, but it still basically does the same thing, which is that it's a curtain. So, yeah, that's good. And how long did it take everybody to see the solid gold deep sea in the window and everyone go sort of a second take on why you would want to dive to the bottom of an ocean with a third of a bag of sugar on your wrist?
Rob?
I guess it must have taken a long time. I wasn't there for the curtain drop descent. I'm sure that there was a deep queue that was systematically underwhelmed as they took a good look at it.
Gold does seem to have been, or precious metals, because effectively I think Rolex only really released one watch that wasn't gold, platinum, or some posh metal. And that seems to have been reflected pretty much throughout the show, that a lot of the new releases have been, or the ones of note, have been gold or precious metal. Did it feel like that was a theme, or, you know, just brands chasing that little bit additional margin by making out of something extra shiny?
Yeah, I actually think it was a quite a good decision strategically, because we've noticed that brand prices have been skyrocketing, obviously through COVID, and then still continued to, which is a questionable move. And I think that they're probably mindful of the reaction to that in the wider community, and perhaps are trying to add a little bit more tangible value to their new propositions without maybe increasing the margin by quite as wide a point as they would have done during the boom times of the pandemic, as it were. So it made some sort of sense to me, because I thought you can't keep dropping new steel sports watch models at like 15K and expect to be greeted with open arms. So maybe that had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. So that was the initial locations that you went to first. What was the first thing that stopped you in your tracks, either for good or for ill, in the exhibition, David?
That's a good question. The first thing I did, actually, after a mash pit of Rolex, is to sit down on one of the couches and just start working on the news releases for the Rolex stuff, since everyone's looking forward to those. It's also very important to cover these ASAP for a number of reasons. And so, that was my first stop, and it always is. And in a way, I don't mind it. You know, of course, there are many other amazing brands and amazing releases, but we all know what people want to read about. And, you know, let's make no mistake, I mean, Rolex still, volume-wise, value-wise, represents a big chunk of the industry. So it's not a surprise that people want to learn about that, first and foremost.
So the first stop was the coffee cart and the free croissant tray, is what you're really saying. You needed breakfast.
Oh, I wish I did. No, I was just like, sit down and just write as fast as possible. And actually, interestingly, I think I can share this little secret, is that our most read article of the first day was a list of discontinued Rolex watches.
Right, really?
Which I just had this idea to like, okay, let's, I think, you know, people care. And last year I was surprised to learn what was discontinued. And this year, again, people care more about what's no longer, you know, in existence in a way in the catalog than what is new, which is, again, quite an interesting thing.
I don't know. I think there's a chance that that was a very famous Rolex Le Mans wearer. Well, very famous. That's maybe overdoing it, but a well-kent... journalist that wears a Rolex Le Mans, just checking that it was now discontinued and therefore worth 10 times as much as he paid for it. So I think we have a certain individual to thank for all of that traffic. Was there anything that was discontinued, Rob, that you were like, why would they discontinue that?
To be honest, I could ask the question about most of the models discontinued if I didn't already feel that it was kind of obvious that they like to drive the hype around these pieces. You know, a great way to make a model more desirable and to sort of drive up the secondary value of it is to discontinue it. Just get rid of it. And then, I mean, it's no surprise to me that article that David mentioned was the most read, because it's the one that's going to have the most immediate impact on what people do with the watches that they already have in their possession. So I'd say that there's great strategic reasons to clean out the collection regularly. Rolex does it pretty well by keeping it under wraps as to what's going to go and building the speculation around that for months in advance of the fair. So nothing really surprised me. It could have been anything. I guess I was surprised maybe to see some other models not be discontinued, and disappointed to not see some other models be brought back that we're all looking forward to. But other than that, par for the course.
Yeah. So the stands are always quite a fascinating thing to see. So who put clearly the most effort into their stand this year versus who just went to the warehouse that they store all the stands from Baselworld and just gathered up some of the old bits and pieces to make something new? What was the most impressive stand? Last year, it was probably JLC. Did JLC roll out the red carpet this year, or the white Chanel carpet this year?
They did have like quite a show put on, but honestly, these booths are nowhere near as expensive or as glamorous or as complex as they used to be, pre-COVID.
And did Roger Dubuis have a, you know, small volcano going off? I've not heard anybody. I think we've had one article on Roger Dubuis. And other than that, they seem to have gone completely under the radar for the whole show. Was there just nothing going on? Not even a volcano?
I mean, last year it was one of the most arresting stands I think I'd ever seen, even Baselworld included, with the massive screens and, yeah, the explosion constantly happening throughout the fair. And this year it was a real step back. It was just some columns of light which didn't seem to be fully functional. And, yeah, I have no idea what they released because I didn't go anywhere near it because nothing was blowing up. So, yeah, that was a step back.
For the first 2 or 3 days, I was every time I walked past the... Roger Dubuis booth, I was, you know, disappointed that there was no blasting music. Usually there would be, you could always catch like the sequence of like the same song just blasting. And then every year it got quieter and quieter because there had been, I'm told, a good number of complaints from neighboring stands, you know, and booths. And it is distracting when you're having a meeting and then you feel like the walls shake around you because let's be honest, not all of these booths are exactly bunkers. And so they've been put on the naughty step for this year. And on the third day, at the end of the third day was the first time when I heard that they were like actually playing like some music, and good on them. You know, I think that there should be at least one brand that is just putting on a bit of a show and just a little bit naughty. And why not Roger Dubuis? I mean, who else? And if you don't do this, it gets just so stale. There should be at least someone who stirs things up a little bit, right? Mm.
And the show was in two halls. Was it very obvious that there was a split between the upper and lower tier of the watch industry if you were in the main hall where Rolex were versus next door? I don't know how it was laid out because I wasn't there myself, but was it obvious that we were starting to see a second tier forming within the brands?
Yeah, I don't know about that exactly. I think the main hall, if you want, with Rolex and Patek, is just almost a lifted floor plan from the old Basel layout. So it doesn't feel particularly exciting or arresting. It doesn't jar in the way you'd expect when you move from one to the other. And they're all connected by these passageways with the little offshoots like the Carré and the Lab and La Place. And, you know, it's it flows pretty nicely. I didn't feel that there was a huge distinction personally, and there are great brands in both sides of the fair, so not for me.
David?
I think it's not too bad. I don't feel the separation in terms of status that you're talking about. There were a few brands relegated to like an upper level, like I think it was Bremont and some others called La Place or whatever it was called. But it was not in a tucked away in the corner where nobody goes kind of vibe. No, it was just like you had to just go there. But once you were there, it was perfectly fine. If anything, it's more like the corner of Belen Ross and Niblo and that region of the fair for the last number of years, ever since they have joined, actually, is kind of a downer in a way. You go there and it's like just a random arrangement of furniture and like huge walls that are blocked off. And it's just not a good vibe. That is the only corner in the entire fair where I feel like there should be a little bit more work dedicated to decorate it in a way that is more inviting.
I'll not ask if you needed a compass to go and find Bremen. That's for a discussion shortly.
Ooh.
Rob, you've used the word arresting 3 times now, I think, in this conversation. Is there something you need to tell us about what went on in Geneva?
It's a police state.
Nothing that I'm legally allowed to discuss. Not as close as usual, actually. I was rather well behaved this time. But there were one or two moments of illegality.
Good. So away from PAL Expo then, we had stuff that was going on at various hotels, mainly, I think, that was a Beau Rivage, the main centre, which tends to be the main centre during Geneva Watch Days or Watch Week or whatever it's called. And then obviously Time to Watch is at the Head Museum. Highlights from those two locations?
Beau Rivage was full of them, to be honest. It was the most exciting part of it for me. I think off the top of my head, the HYT T1, so another soft reboot of one of my favourite brands, to be fair, because I love what they do. I've always loved the brands. I think that that's like true innovation, a much overused word, of course. But I'd seen the new models a few weeks ago, just on renders, and I was skeptical as to how the dials were going to look in real life. I was very impressed with the finishing. I thought they had a lot more visual impact than I was expecting, but the best thing about them was the case redesign. So it's very compact now. They've dropped the diameter down to something like 45 millimeters, which doesn't sound like a wearable watch by any means, but the strap system that they've created, which is very similar to like the Hublot quick release, plugs in to the side with an immediate drop off. So even with a small wrist, like, well, mine's pretty average, about 16.5 centimeters, but it's more than comfortable on there. It sits lower than you'd expect for an HYT. Everything's very tight. The case finishing is superb. The angles are great. It reduces like the overall bulk of it on the wrist quite nicely. So that was a real highlight, and I'm very excited to see if this iteration of HYT can soar to the heights it deserves.
Good stuff. David, away from PAL Expo, what was your favorite?
I was at the Time to Watches and all of that. So we had team members visit Borivaj and others. Time to Watches is great. It was distinctly much less depressing than in years prior. I mean, I don't know what it was about that venue, but in previous years, I was like, I have to get out of here ASAP. But this year, it was for whatever reason, it was a better vibe. Maybe it's the spring. Springtime in Geneva has helped a lot there. Anyway, it was a couple of good meetings, excellent brands. So I just want to clear it up that just because somebody's not at the PAL Expo, it doesn't mean that it's like a B tier brand or something. You can make amazing discoveries and fantastic encounters in these off site venues. You know, the standout for me was Bayo. You know, BA111OD, so Bayo, which we've covered a number of times, but it's like their tourbillons and stuff. I'm getting one for review, that's for sure. I just can't wait. It's 100% Swiss made, open work tourbillon. Wow, that's just, I can't wait to review that watch.
Hi, I'm Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch. I'd like to tell you about Bezel, the modern app for buying and selling authenticated high-end watches. Bezel isn't like other platforms. Bezel was designed exclusively for today's timepiece collectors and enthusiasts, offering choice, convenience, safety, and service. In addition to personally authenticating each timepiece sold on the marketplace, Bezel also offers a personal concierge service to walk you through any part of the watch buying or selecting process. Want something not currently listed on Bezel? Their concierge service is happy to seek one out for you. Buying and selling a watch can be scary as well as challenging, especially with all the options out there today. Bezel uses a modern, intuitive interface to deliver a class-leading technology experience that makes it simple and fun to search through available watches or list one you currently want to sell. Try Bezel today and discover what others like you are already excited about. Get the Bezel app or use the getbezel.com website. That's GETBEZEL.com. Thanks.
Well, we like to go and have a look at what was the most commented article during the week. And there is a standout for good or ill. When all said and done about Patek and Rolex and all the rest of it, the thing that everyone's been talking about has been Bremont. That's where everybody's piled in for good or ill. So let's try and dissect what's happened, what's going on, and the extent to which we're all just enjoying giving someone a kicking, which actually is maybe not quite so deserving. It's just become a mass geek pile-on. So, Rob, you strike me as a man who's got his finger on the pulse. Tell us what has happened, first of all, at Bremont. What's the company reorganisation that has led us to where we are and then being for the first time at the fair?
So I don't work for Bremont anymore, as I did many years ago. So I'm not on the inside. So take everything I say with a pinch of salt. But from what we know, there was a big investment in the company recently, which was, I think, necessary to keep the gears turning. And the brothers, Nick and Giles, have taken something of a step back, visibly and practically, in the involvement of the company, and certainly the design of the watches. And they brought in Davide Cerato, who has previously had great success with Tudor, with his design for the Black Bay. He then went to Mont Blanc, and then had a brief stint at HYT. during one of their recent reboots, and now he's landed at Bremont, and he has been charged with redesigning the entire collection and repositioning the brands from top to bottom. New logo, new wordmark, new color scheme, and at least in principle, a new price point. That was what I was told as the meeting commenced, although as it wore on, it became less and less obvious where these savings were actually going to hit the customer's wallet. So I don't know if you want me to dive into any of what I actually saw. Maybe we can take turns, because otherwise I'll go on a 25-minute rant.
We will take turns. David, if you're from outer space and you just landed in the PAL Expo, as you know, sometimes it does appear some folk have during the week, and you were walking to Bremont, knew nothing about them, and you walked in and saw what you saw, give it a rating out of 10.
Like a 6. But people treated it as though it were a 1. And it has happened before. I feel like there's this strong tendency that every once in a while the community, you know, certain parts of the community just awfully enjoys ganging up on brands. And, you know, we them ourselves criticize brands and we laugh at them and we would tease them and whatever. So it's not as though it's all praise on a Block to Watch ever. But still, I feel like this outlash was a little bit overdone. It was sort of an overreaction in a way. You know, you can spin it in a way that you say, sure, people at least care about the brand, which is good. It's also hilarious how people are now crying back the old Bremont that they criticized just as viciously. You know, so I feel like, oh, I hate this design. Well, I miss the old design. I mean, just come on. You know, just it's
you didn't like the old design
at some
either.
Point you make yourself look ridiculous. If it's like always bad, whatever happens, and then suddenly whatever used to happen or they used to make is just suddenly like acceptable. So I feel like it was a venerable effort. It failed in some ways, but not all the ways, and definitely not to the extent. And honestly, I've never owned a Bremont. I've never had any meaningful interaction with them. I don't think I've ever reviewed one. But just from the outside, to see something like this happen to any of the major industry players without it being like a horrendous scam on the customer or whatever else, it's weird. And in a way, and I'll close this this thought here. If you read my article, it's roughly titled "Why the In-House Craze Was and Is Stupid." In it, I also highlight the hypocrisy of the community sometimes, and maybe, you know, I'm not going to make any friends with this monologue, I know, but still, I feel like sometimes there's a little bit of a hypocrisy here in the extent to which some brands are criticized and how much of a pass others get with pretty nasty stuff that we actually report on. So,
Wow,
yep. Not easy.
Yeah, so, and I think that's probably my feeling is, I mean, maybe it's just one of those things when you see the kid getting bullied often enough, eventually you feel sorry for the kid. And for whatever reason, Bremont, and whether it is from that original claim many moons ago about an in-house movement that clearly wasn't, just appear to have been a brand that very quickly people react to. Now, whether that's just in our community, whether actually these Bremonts in the window with your average Joe and Jane looking at a watch is any less likely to buy these ones than they were the old ones. I've got a Bremont Boeing. It's a great watch. Love the triptych case. It's a big watch. It's a chronograph and a GMT. So it does everything. It's a one-stop tool watch, and I love it for that. But for some reason, which I can't quite put my finger on, maybe Rob, you can, why they seem to get a bit more abuse more easily. They more easily upset everybody. Everybody goes to 11 much more quickly with Bremont than they seem to with others. Is it just because, as David says, he's never had one in for review, he's never had any meaningful interaction with the brand, so actually that makes it a fairly soft target. You're not going to upset anyone that's, you know, spending megabucks with you, or that you're selling their watches, as some media houses are wanting to do. I don't know. Thoughts?
I think that perhaps it comes down to the way that Bremont has always told amazing stories. I think for a long time, the brand was better at telling stories than it was at making watches. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I think many of the success stories in our industry, especially in the modern era, could say the same thing. But Bremont was, in my opinion, by far and away the best marketing brand in terms of what it got out of its product offering. And I used to build them, you know, so I know that they're good, solid watches. I enjoy wearing Bremont, the older style of Bremont. I have an S500 still that I adore. And I thought that the boys, Nick and Giles, were great ambassadors, and they wore their hearts on their sleeve, oftentimes maybe too much and too preemptively for the community. Obviously, there was the mistake, the in-house proprietary mix-up, which did tarnish the brand a little bit and has lingered. It's been, I guess, a decade at least. I can't quite keep tabs on it, but it feels like a long time. But they always said what they wanted to do. Their goal was to bring back mass manufacturing to the British Isles. And they never really got to the point where it was happening and it was rolling on a significant scale. And they kind of traded quite openly on this aspiration for many, many years without having achieved the goal. And then you come to this rebrand. And there are lots of little things about the rebrand. I mean, you said if you're an alien, you've just landed and this is the first time you've seen Bremont, for example, what would you think of it as a brand? I would have issue with what it is now as a brand, even if it didn't have its heritage. And I say that loosely in terms of the last 20 years. But what it did have originally was a clear design language that set itself apart from other things. Not radically, but well enough. It had great storytelling, it had good branding, and it had great, sensible faces on the front of it with Nick and Giles. And now they're stepping not completely away from the aviation side of things, but they want to be known as like the tool watch maker. And they've got a new slogan, which is something along the lines of higher, further, deeper, faster. Now, I was sitting in the meeting with a massive screen in front of me, and I was on the right-hand side of the table. So the words deeper and faster were right in front of my face. And I was thinking, I probably would have workshopped that like a little bit more, because if you're like speeding past in a car and on a billboard and that's all you see, that's not, you don't think of a luxury watch brand. And I get what they're trying to communicate, but that was the first like warning sign that, okay, this is, this may not sort of hit the mark as well as they think it's going to. Then the watch has come out. And the first piece, nice enough from the photos, I think it's pretty cool in its own way. I think the logo is a bit big and, you know, the printing on the dial is a bit much, but I get it. The thing was, they were really laboring the 904L steel, which is an upgrade, as far as they say, to the previous 316L that they've been using. But there's more nickel in 904L, so it isn't necessarily a better thing for many people to wear. And the tolerances of the manufacturing of 316L and 904 actually overlap in some spaces. So good 316L is actually as good or better than bad 904. So there isn't any hard and fast rule to say this is a superior material, but it's supposed to add value, perceived value, which was the goal in reducing the price point, which they dropped for this initial model to around £2,500 or euros, ballpark. And I was like, okay, interesting. That's a new price point for Bremont. That is what they said they were going to do. And then they roll out the Power Reserve model, and I'm thinking, okay, it's probably £3,000. It's actually about £4,000. And then they roll out the chronograph, and I'm thinking, well, it has to be at least £5,000. And it's closer to €1,000. So I'm thinking, okay, very, very quickly, these new pieces have leapt up into the prices that match or exceed the previous core collection. And then the next thing that comes out is a titanium DLC-coated geosphere tourbillon.
Yeah, which I can't seem to find anywhere now.
Well, I'm not surprised. hiding it might be a smart move. I sat there in a meeting, and generally I try and retain a veneer of professionalism, generally. But I said that is, no word of a lie, the word I used was ghastly. I was like, that, like, you know, which one of your ambassadors, and I got a great list of ambassadors, which one of those guys, like real adventuremen, outdoorsmen, doing all their mad endurance challenges, is going to pick the tourbillon for his mission? I don't know. Then the rose gold chronograph came out that was over 25,000, and I was like, okay, I don't know what this story is anymore. And I appreciate what they tried to do. I think the execution is way off, not just in the concept of it, but also in the actual material quality of a lot of the watches. There were easy flaws that I saw, like in the entry-level stuff. For example, the Lumacast numerals on the dial, they're not thick enough to overawe the black of the dial upon which they sit, so they don't match in terms of color with the hands. There's a slight disparity, which is very obvious in the daylight. And then the white dial model is barely legible because there's no outline to the numbers on the dial, which would have been wise, I think, to put like a black outline around those, you know, off-white trench watch inspired numerals. And then the finishing on the cases. I mean, you've got the flat top of the cushion case that drops down into the lugs, and the transition is buttery and imprecise. And I don't care if it's 2,500, you know, it could be 750, and I wouldn't buy it. So,
and so has the whole in-house, which was laterally a movement in partnership with Orage via their ultimate parent company or tech provider. Has that all gone? Is it now Sellita? Is it now Sellita all the way down, to coin a phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah. Seemingly like for the most part. Yeah, right. So it seems like that's on the shelf. I don't know. David, have you heard any more about that?
I'm not sure what movements they use, honestly. I can't remember anything. We saw a number of watches, a few watches. Some of them were really nice on the wrist, honestly. It's, you know, to be clear, I'm not suggesting that I'm trying to tell people whether they should criticize or lash out on something or not. If you want to lash out, lash out. But sometimes, actually quite often, I feel like some brands, you know, you just lash out on them, sure. But others are get away with crazy stuff in comparison to this. And yet they receive, you know, not a fraction of this. Most of the time, that's because they're historic brands and people are like, they try and go out of their way to justify them. I'm not trying to justify what Bremen is doing. I have no horse in this race. I'm not going to say I could care less, because honestly, it's just like, it's just this release of energy from the community every once in a while. And sometimes it becomes sort of an echo chamber too, where people are like, oh, you're criticizing, look at me, how well I can criticize. And you know, and then people are like, how deep can I dig in this wound just to be able to say that I've dug the deepest, right? So that's sort of the psychology of things sometimes. But again, criticism in its own right is a good thing, and it can be part of a healthy discussion. Mm.
So, prediction, buy, sell, or hold. So, are you buying Bremen stock because you think 5 years from now it's going to be a company that's worth more? Are you selling, getting out of Dodge as fast as you can because it's on its way out? Obviously, it's effectively had to be rescued. You know, it hasn't made a profit, I think, since... certainly the last 8 years, I don't think it's made any money, so it's continuing to drain money. But there are a number, to kind of finesse on David's point a bit, that's the case with a number of brands. There are a large number of brands that never make any money, and they're just the equivalent to rich people owning football clubs. It's just they happen to own a watch brand, and that's what they subsidise and keep chucking money at, because it's a trinket.
It's a nice hobby.
Or it's a nice hobby. Or is Bremen a hold? Yeah, let's hold on to it and just see how it gets on in the next the wee while. Rob, buy, sell, or hold?
Well, to be quite frank, I'd be more tempted to buy shares in the company today than I would have been a week ago, because I think you'd get them at a decent price. I definitely wouldn't be selling my holding at this point. I don't think the road is run. I think there's a way back. Like everything I say, I've not read a single word of criticism about Bremen, because I haven't read a single word of any coverage since I got back, because I've been sleeping. So I was there, held them in my hands, and like I say, I was intimately involved in the creation of the old line that the brothers were involved in designing. I prefer that. And I'm not criticizing because it's like, you know, groupthink or cool be on the bandwagon. I got a lot of tangible things that I can point to and say, I don't get that from a branding perspective. I can see what's wrong with that from a product perspective. Is it the end of the road? No, they can try this as an experiment. We've seen brands come back from worse. You know, like David said, some brands do much worse and nobody even touches them. So I guess as an optimist, I'll buy some low-ranked Bremen stock today. Yeah,
excellent. A Category B shareholder. David, buy, sell, or hold?
I would refrain from providing any form of financial advice on this one. Jeez. You do you. That's my financial advice.
Now I'm going to need to put in a disclaimer into the text and the show notes and the audio track and all the rest of it. Anyway, good stuff. Right, we are going to play a bit of Hitmas maybe as we bring the show into a close. I'm going to let Guy, who's going to join us, into the room. Let's see, Guy. Good morning, Guy. Guy, meet Rob. Rob, meet Guy.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, Rob.
So, okay, we are now joined by a small but perfectly formed Hitmas Maybe team. Rob, perfect. Yeah, Rob is pointing at himself going, who, me? Yes, Rob, you're a gorgeous man and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. And Guy. Thanks, and Guy, our strap guru for those that tuned into the live show. Everything else is now being ignored, and Guy is purely all about the straps. Forget about
it. I need to change that reputation.
Yes, so we need to see if we can get you to comment on more than just whether it's a nice strap or whether it fits. And ruining my overall opinion of Ferdinand Berthoud,
I'm sorry about that. But then everyone agreed, so that I kind of wasn't,
it was
sorry.
True that you did ruin it for me forever, Ferdinand Berthoud, because of a badly fitting, possibly quite inexpensive strap that they've put on their latest gorgeous creation. But there we go. So let's just find out who we've got and where they are and what they're wearing. Rob, where actually are you and what do you have on the wrist?
So I'm in Dresden in Germany, about 40 minutes away from Glaceter, the horological heartland of the nation. It's where I live.
I think, Rob, do you say that every time somebody in the watch community asks you where you live? Say, I live in Dresden. It's quite close to Glashütte.
Yeah, mostly. Just to sort of hammer home how much of a fangirl I am of Glashütte watches. But today I'm not wearing Glashütte. Today I am wearing my Arkanaut Arc 2 Groovy Fordite piece. Obviously repping the brand. So yeah. That's cool. From Denmark. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Piece unique, like most of the Ford, well, all of the Fordite pieces Fordite. And many of the other pieces that they make.
Cool. Does, with the demise of the car industry in Europe, do they eventually run out of Fordite?
Well, guaranteed. It's not even anything to do with the current state of the car market. The kind of Fordite that you need to make a dial this hard and resilient no longer exists, because it's the old illegal paints, the solvent ones that aren't, after the end of the 90s or mid 90s, it stopped being viable. Now it's all water based and it falls to bits. We tried to do it with some McLaren P1 paint to make like a special one, and it just like flaked off and it was rubbish. So,
Right, okay. Yeah,
there is a finite resource and we are running out.
Excellent. Well, I only wish I'd been into watches earlier, because I used to own what was a defunct truck and bus factory which had a massive paint shop in it, but unfortunately we demolished it. But I'll give you a wee contact after the show. There we go. Guy, where are you and what are you wearing?
I'm on the sunny south coast, near Bournemouth, wearing a prototype of the D-Trash, what we call the Gotham's Vigilante. It's definitely not called Batman, because that would be a trademark infringement.
Good stuff. And I'm in Scotland wearing a Panerai, because I refuse to wear the D-Trash that Guy has sent me because of Ferdinand Berthoud.
So the straps are much nicer than the Ferdinand Berthoud.
Strapgate, we're now calling it. Good stuff. Right, well, let's have a look and review some watches. Now, we did, I will share the screen. We did on last week's show posit the theory that it was impossible to ruin the Cartier Santos. And then Guy, I think it was yourself, pointed out in the chat that maybe Cartier had taken up the challenge of ruining the Cartier Santos by producing this, the Cartier Santos Dumont Rewind watch. Rob, did you see this in Geneva?
I did, yeah. Good. It's a handsome model in real life.
Good stuff. Well, let's, without further ado, other than saying this is basically a watch you can't tell the time on sensibly, let's give it a hit, a miss, or a maybe. So on the count of three, Rob, I'm going to put a drum roll into this, because this is the first unveiling of your official Hitmas Maybe signage. One, two, three, go. Hitmas or maybe. maybe, and a miss. So two maybes and a miss. Guy, tell us why it's a miss.
Well, I'm assuming we can't judge this on design of the Dumont, because the design of the Dumont is like amazing and classic and all time. So take that out, because it's obviously a beautiful watch to look at. It's stupid because it works backwards. And I think, like, the other watches that do something clever that have come out at Watches and Wonders, like the IWC we talked about, like the pocket watch we talked about last time, I feel like at least that's hard to do. Like, it's really hard to make a watch that works 45 million years or whatever it is. I can't imagine it's... I don't know that much about the technicalities of watchmaking, but I can't imagine it's that hard to make a watch that works backwards. And my other point of comparison was the Frank Muller, I think it's called the Jump Hour, that always tells the time, but the hours are in the wrong places. The Crazy Hours, sorry. I was like, that's clever. To do that feels like an amazingly clever bit of engineering, to tell the time in a weird way. This doesn't feel like a clever way to tell the time badly.
Yeah. Rob, is it just as simple as flipping the movement over to make it run backwards?
Well, there are a couple of ways you can do it, some more complex than others. It's not the most complicated thing, and people don't indulge in it very often because, as Guy says, it's a bit stupid. If you think the primary function of a watch is to tell the time, then maybe it's not the most intuitive way forward. Although there is at least one man in the industry that would ardently disagree with you, and that's David Henderson Stewart of Rakita, you know, the Russian brand.
Yeah.
Because he actually has watches that run backwards already, and he is absolutely adamant that it's the natural way to tell the time because of the way that the sun travels across the sky. He's explained this to me on multiple occasions in person. I've never been wholly convinced, to be honest. But he definitely is.
So see, I've seen that point, actually.
No, but hold on a second. Surely if you just turn... Hold on. If so the sun goes... But surely if you just face the other direction, it's going the other way.
It's something to do with, like, the passage of the sun over, like, a gnomon in a sundial, and he's like, I've just been conditioned to read time from, like, you know, left to right. And I'm like, well, we read in the West, at least we read from left to right. Just everything seems to flow in that direction. It feels like forward motion to me. Most of us wear our watches on our left wrist, and again, the hands are sort of going forwards, as in away from you, which makes more intuitive sense. But look, I gave it a maybe and not a miss, simply because it is a Cartier Santos and it's beautiful. Like, it's a gorgeous watch. If it told the time properly, then it would get a definite hit, 100%. You know, these like rich colors, like the burgundies or the greens and the blues, they really work on that platform. So love the watch. Yeah, but maybe because it's a bit silly.
Yeah, I think that's why I would give it a maybe. Is it's just stupid. It's not big, it's not clever, and it's not going to win you any more friends. It does lead into the whole idea of how many people wear their watches simply as jewellery. And if you're going to wear a watch as jewellery, then a gorgeous burgundy dialed Santos with the... Is it a ruby cabochon? I don't know if
it's
like a ruby
it.
Or if it's... then, you know, there isn't many prettier watches than a Santos that's dressed up like this, for sure. But $38,500 to not be able to tell the time. As you say, I could buy a $500 Rakita to not be able to tell the time. I'm voting maybe on this one. Be very interested to know if, because you get like your 24-hour time tellers, your single hander, so like your Cosmonauts, your what's the brand that does the single handers?
Meistersinger.
And it takes it doesn't take as long as you would think to get used to reading the time with that. I am curious as to whether this is just so counterintuitive, literally counterintuitive, that it actually does take a long time to be able to read it. And, you know, it's one of these things, by the time you need to tell the time has moved significantly on, that the time is already wrong. Because it took you that long to...
I think you're right, because it looks too much. Like, if you look at, like, compare it to, like, a Gerald Genta Mickey Mouse watch. Yeah. Like, at least you know it doesn't look like a normal watch, so you instinctively have to work out how it tells the time. Whereas this, it looks like it... I mean, that watch in the picture is at 10 to 2, in my head, but actually it's at...
what time actually is it?
10.
It's
not,
ten.
Is it?
No, is it not 10 to 10?
No, you're right. I think it is 10 past, because I thought it was 10 to 10 as well.
11.
It's 10 past.
It must be 10 past.
It's run. Yeah. It's 10 past 10. Yes, it is 10 past 10.
So yeah.
Any watch where you need to have a conversation, a group therapy session, try and figure out what time it is, yeah, you're right, it is 10 past 10, because that's moving towards 11.
I saw a cartoon of somebody using it as an excuse to be late for work, which...
Mm. But then
again, though, none of those stories make sense, because if you've got $38,500 to spend on a watch, you're not late for work, are you? It's your own boss.
See, the thing is, it runs backwards, but also, so it's saying that it's 10 to 10, no, 10 past 10, but should the XI, should they also put that backwards?
And the logo.
And the X22.
Oh, you could have inverted the logo the other way.
Inverted, now that, an inverted watch, where the whole, everything is a mirror image, would that be right? I don't know.
Yeah, no,
that,
you're right.
That I get.
The numerals should be the other way around.
Rob, 100%. Rob's having, anyone watching on video, Rob's having a moment.
I'm having a moment. I've got an extra accessory. Like, so if you have everything inverted, you can have like a bejeweled bangle with like a complex system of mirrors above it. So you can then like, you know, reflect the dial and look like, read it from a different
angle. You need a full Hunter case front that's got the mirror on the top of it. You know, like those sundials you can buy for your wrist.
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll flip up a mirror and you read the mirror.
Huh. You should be able to do that. That should be how, if it works perfectly in a mirror, but this doesn't work perfectly in a mirror because the logo is wrong and the numerals are wrong.
Yep.
Like, that should have been the test for it. Or it should have just put a normal movement in, had a beautiful red cartoon, Santos, and would have really liked it.
That's what a great idea. So
I vote for that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm now going to... So anyone who's listening to this, you're now going to have heard, like, 4 minutes of just bleep, because we've just had the most marvellous idea for a watch that we're going to make, and we don't want to let you all in on what the secret is. So, yeah,
welcome back to the show. It's a marvellous idea of... Is the marvellous idea red Carte du Monde, or is it the mirror version?
No, it's the mirror version. Come on. Okay. Come on, guy, keep up. Right. So that's our Carte chat. Next up, and this is one specifically for Guy. This is going to be the Patek Philippe revives the classic Nautilus chronograph with reference 5980... -60G, or more importantly, it appears to have a denim strap. So, Rob, did you see this one at Watches and Wonders, and is it a denim strap?
I don't know.
Without further ado, a hit, a miss, or a maybe.
Oh, God.
Yeah, two hits and a maybe. I shouldn't like this. Why am I giving this a hit? It's so wrong, but it's so right. And it's all yours for probably stupid money. Let me scroll. For 67,000 Swiss francs for 1/1/800th of a pair of jeans on your wrist. Yeah, I like this far too much. And I'm not normally a fan of these chronographs. I'm not normally a fan of Patek, but I really like this, Rob. Join me in my therapy session. Why do you like this?
Yeah, so it was very close to being a maybe for me. And I changed it because I love it. I had it as a maybe in my mind because I was like, well, I think the denim strap or that any kind of aesthetic like that is very on Patek. And so I was going to vote based on a branding perspective. But to be quite honest, it's an absolutely gorgeous watch. The colorway works. I'm a fan of fabric or textured straps, at least. The watch head itself is a stunner. It's a beautiful dial color. I love Nautilus chronographs. I mean, 67,000 francs, if you can get it at that price and if you have that kind of money to burn, it's fine given the current collection and what it goes for. So, yeah, I think it's undeniably Well, not undeniably, obviously. If you hate blue and if you hate denim and if you hate watches, it's a piece of crap. But, if you know, I think it's undeniably beautiful. Like, it's a good design. Is it very Patek? No. Is that a terrible thing? In this case, maybe not. So no. That's why it got my vote.
Guy, do you hate watches, hate blue, hate denim?
I do. I am going to get rid of my reputation by not commenting on the strap at all, and just leave that to the Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears fans out there to work out that one, or even the cause, if anyone remembers them. I gave it a maybe. I was like, do you know what? I've not seen many chronographs like this, and I saw it at first, and I was like, oh, I quite like that. It's quite clever. And then I saw the dual time ones. I thought the dual time ones were really nice with like the kind of slightly skeleton-y hand. I really like those. The reason it's a maybe and not a hit is that if I was to get a Nautilus, which I'm not doing anytime soon, but if I were to get a Nautilus, the chronograph would probably be at the back of the queue versus like the three hand or the dual time. Like, it's kind of clever and it's kind of neat, but it's such a kind of pure watch without it, the pure design. I don't think the chronograph enhances it in any way. Whereas actually as a three-hander, it's a lot nicer watch. That's the only reason I go. It's a nice watch, but if you put the dual time, the three-hand, and this in front of me and said pick one, this would always be at the back of the queue.
Mm. Well, at least it doesn't have to have the word home written at the bottom of it to somehow remind you whether you're home or away. But we'll not deal with that particular Patek heresy on today's show. Next up, we're gonna kind of do a bit of a group review from a brand that was at the show, and this is Zenith. So Zenith had a number of iterations on the Defy. So they had this Zenith Defy Revival, the Zenith Defy Extreme as the diver. I don't have it to hand for some reason, but the Zenith Defy Chronograph. So overall, a vote based on Zenith for Watches and Wonders. Was it a hit of a show, a miss of a show, or a maybe of a show? 1, 2, 3, go. Yeah. Ooh. I thought that was coming into focus as a hit from dear Rob, but it was coming as a miss. Rob, tell us why this is a miss. You surprise me.
I hate to do this. I really do, because I love what Zenith has tried to do here for a couple of reasons. I think, well, I've been banging the drum for a sort of early 2000s revival for quite a while, like the kind of big Breitling Chronomat style, the sort of glossy polished Roman numerals, bright colors, like wacky oversized watches for ages. And this release was, it felt like it came right out of 2009, like the colors and the size of the things on the wrist was really, really surprising to me. I love that Zenith has been experimental. I love that they've taken a punt on it. But the two things that really stuck with me was, I don't see Zenith in these releases very much at all. The Defy on the screen right now with the orange bezel, the throwback, the revival, the A3648 is obviously, you know, drawn from the heritage, but it's a weird watch on the wrist. It's bigger than I expected. It wears a lot bigger. It's very top heavy. It's not elegant. It has a pretty standard Zenith Elite movement inside of it. And I believe that one in particular retails for about $7,700 US, and the other ones are over 10. And that's my second bugbear with it, is the price. Because I'm looking at these pieces in the context of the brand, what you can get for a similar price and what you can get from other brands at a similar price as well. And I think that I'm convinced that other brands have more to offer at that particular price point. So, yeah, I don't know. I want to love it. I love the brand of Zenith. I love the El Primero. I've got a huge soft spot for that. But it's just not enough here for what's being charged and what other brands are doing to make me say, yeah, this is going to be a hit.
Hmm. Will's not here. We've retired Will, and he's flip-flopping, so maybe I have to change my mind from a hit to maybe not a miss. I mean, I'm a big fan of Zenith. Just, yeah, no, yeah, you've got me wondering. So, I think I would like to try on the Extreme Diver. I'm not a big fan, it has to be said, of the revival stuff. I think there's a reason why it had to be revived, and it probably shouldn't have been, like, keep your history in the past. There's a reason why you moved on. But the Extreme Diver, I think there's a bit of cognitive distance because I just don't associate Zenith with diving watches. I associate them with chronographs. And so this, yeah, is maybe a bit like that. It just doesn't feel like it's a Zenith. But I suspect it's probably made to the Zenith quality, which is always great in my opinion. And so these will feel really, really good to actually wear and use, and they're dead clear. They're nice and chunky, which suits me as a Panerai wearer. Guy, your thoughts? Do you have a favourite out of these three?
Yeah, I mean, you're almost convincing me down to a maybe. I think that my instinctive reaction when I saw it was, it's nice that someone's trying to be a bit different, trying to be a bit colourful, trying to, you know, bring some stuff to it. It's got a weird mix of like geometric shapes and circles that come in. It's way expensive, the Diver. I mean, you've got to compare it. It's, what is it, 20% more than a Sub, which is kind of a benchmark. So it's like, who's going to buy it? But I just kind of like that they're doing something a bit different in a world of quite a lot of copycats. And I think some of the revival stuff's good. I really like, is it the Chronomaster revival, which is a bit small, but it's kind of cool. It's an old one. I like Zenith as a brand, so I didn't want to be too mean to them. I think they've got some nice watches in there. but yeah, I'm kind of between the, I was a hit, but I'm going towards a maybe now. It's got some, I think it's good stuff.
I love it. I love Zenith, but how many Zeniths would you buy, Guy, before you got down to buying this one, really?
Yeah, but I do think they're probably kind of overpriced for what they are. The Skyline's not, that one actually is the really nice one.
Yeah.
Cool. I think that's lovely.
Rob?
I also like the Skyline. Good. That's more what I expect from Zenith. I could get on board with that one, absolutely. And like I said, I just feel like there's a lot of Zeniths I would buy before I bought either of those new models, and I don't feel like I'm missing out by not having them.
Hmm. Cool. Right. Final for today. We'll just keep it short and snappy. But final for today is actually going to be this as a surprise. The bold, solid gold Tudor Black Bay 58 18K watch. A solid gold Black Bay from brand Rolex that retails at $32,100 USD on the solid gold bracelet, or 18 grand if you just want the case to be solid gold. So with what you know and what you've seen, is this a hit, a miss, or a maybe? I've just changed my mind. I've just gone from miss to hit. We have a hit, a miss, and two misses. Yeah, let's face it, this is a miss. Who in their right mind is buying a $32,000 gold Tudor? But see if you had more money than sense, which anyone spending 32 grand on anything probably does have more money than sense. Why would you not buy this? Because it's fundamentally gorgeous looking. It's just a great looking watch. Whether it would stay good looking for very long, I think somewhat of a debate. Rob, you gave it a miss. How long do you think you could keep this in pristine condition?
About 8 seconds, probably. the finish is nice.
Would it take you longer to read the time off the Cartier or longer to scratch this up?
Definitely the Cartier, yeah. This would be scratched up, but the finish is good. You know, at least it's not got polished surfaces all over the place. So, yeah, it's fine. as a watch. It's very dull. The dial and the bezel color are just very drab and a bit grim, and it reminds me of the weather back home. So as much as that touches a certain part of my soul, it's not what I want on my wrist always. And to your point, like, if you've got more money than sense, there's only, everybody in the world only has so many parcels of $32,100 in their bank, and there's a lot of other things I would spend those on before I got to this. Like, even what kind of watches, imagine the watches you could have. For me, this doesn't make any sense. Nobody asked for it. It's maybe goes back to what I said at the top of the show, of a lot of brands like chucking out these precious metal pieces to set a marker point that further justifies the hikes of the lower end collection.
Yeah.
Tudor had some interesting releases this year that were what people were after, maybe not exactly, but this to me was not one of them, and it's just boring. Mm. And I don't want to spend $32,000 on boring.
Mm. I do like this strap buckle.
Well, buy the strap then.
That's quite...
You have a strap.
I think that's quite clever that someone's thought to put the Tudor wave, so to speak, into the buckle. I'm quite impressed with that. Guy, you gave it a miss.
Well, I think if you like the look of it, I mean, I saw it and I thought it was they did a Harrods special edition one in green, and I thought it was that one. And you can get that one for a third of the price. And I, like... Tudor is the $5,000, you know, kind of $3,000-$5,000 market. Mm. Why? Like, that's... I actually think it's kind of... I see Rob's point, actually, of kind of the halo pricing effect of, you know, like, you know, Hermes do a $30,000 bag because suddenly a $3,000 one looks cheap. But...
Guy's currently going in and he said, going, how quickly can I make a gold D-trash? To recycled gold, it's a thing.
But there is a thing, but I almost think it's brand damaging for them, because they are not... Tudor isn't a $30,000 watch brand. Mm. It's like a single digits watch brand. You know, it's a good few grand watch brand, and that's how they should be thought of. And they've done really well at that mark. And the other watches they brought out, I mean, I still think, whether it was planned or not, by the Rolex group to bring out the Coke that everyone thought was going to be a Rolex as a Tudor. I thought that was a stroke of genius, on purpose or not. I think this is... I don't understand who's buying a $30,000 Tudor. I think it's...
Yeah.
And they're not a crazy brand. Like, Cartier can do it. Cartier can be like, yeah, buy a $30,000 watch that tells the time backwards. It doesn't work. but that's not the brand of Tudor.
It's that meme... where, you know, they're all sitting around the board table and somebody makes a suggestion and then gets thrown out the window. You know, the suggestion that needed to be made was the Tudor, it needs to be gold, but it also needs to tell the time backwards. And that, especially as it's only got hour marker, it's only got like pip markers. Tell the time backwards and it's not even got any numerals on it to help. That's what we need. Anyway, great stuff. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. It does feel... like, this show has mainly been about brands ruining themselves by producing certain products that maybe they should just have kept clear of. But I am sure in the weeks to come, we will dig more into the releases and the consequences. We'll be back with a lot more actual news next week rather than just continuing the reviews of Watches and Wonders. And we'll welcome back, hopefully, Ariel and Ripway and these guys, maybe to another Hitmas, maybe. Thank you for tuning in, and hopefully next week we'll be live on YouTube when we record. So if you're around on Tuesday morning, go to your Vlog to Watch channel and you can tune into that. But goodbye from me, and goodbye from these two. Goodbye.
Bye.